Firstly, can I say thank you to Stephen for that fulsome introduction. I really don't think I'm as bad as he makes me sound. I should tell you that my brothers, of whom you now know I have seven, maintain that I was too stupid to do anything at the right time. Everybody else took silk at 45, I had to go and do it at 35. And when I eventually became Attorney General, their only response was, "What took you so long?" So you see before you, I have to confess, one of my father's failures. You've just heard that I'm the 10th, I'm my mother and father's 10th only child. And my father believed that actually science was the way forward, and that all his children should be scientists, and I should have been the physicist. He had a pharmacologist, biochemist, he had the lot, but he didn't have a physicist. So you see before you, ladies and gentlemen, a failed Scotland family physicist. But I do want to thank the Vice-Chancellor for kindly inviting me to come and speak to you at the law school here at the University of Sussex, and also to thank Stephen, because Stephen has not only the wonderful accolade of being the professor here, but he also has to receive my thanks for a number of other very important things he's done to be of great assistance to our country, because he has given a very important contribution as Her Majesty's to Her Majesty's Crown Prosecution Service Inspectorate as a non-executive board member and to the advisory board for the Joint Criminal Justice Inspections. And I'm very pleased to see, hidden at the back of the room, our new Chief Inspector Designate, Mike Fuller, who is currently masquerading as a policeman. It is wonderful to be here with so many people who are involved and ensuring that the criminal justice system in Sussex is not only fit for purpose but thriving. And so my talk this evening is about delivering an excellent public prosecution service at this key point in the development of independent prosecution services in England and Wales. Now, I intend to look back briefly on how things started out in 1986 and to take stock of the enormous journey of reform that we have travelled between 2000 and 2010. The service has now changed, and changed quite radically during that period, but also to look forward to perhaps a radically different service that we will need to provide in order to meet the anticipated changes in the criminogenic patterns by 2020. So this is our 2020 vision. And I'm sure that many of you in this room have been travelling on the same journey as I have, and that you are as committed as I am to meeting the challenges of the future. But many of you who are part of the student body are only just starting on this journey. And so I don't want you to be frightened about how the world will look like by the time you're in control. Just be ready for the fact that you will be in control. And those of us who are older need to be very kind to you, because you are going to be looking after us in our old age and determining the quality of the democracy in which we live. So can I just say to you, you're all very beautiful and talented. And I want you to remember I said that when I'm 85. So, a little background, first of all. First, some ancient history about my role as Attorney General and how prosecutorial responsibility has changed and developed over the ages. No working day passes without my being reminded of the history of the Office of the Attorney General. Just inside the entrance of the building that houses my office is a picture of Lawrence Delbrock, who is often regarded as the first King's Attorney. It was in around 1247. over 700 years ago, and rather longer ago than I'm afraid the Crown Prosecution Service was created in 1986. And he was appointed to sue the king's affairs of his pleas before him. And the first person to be called Attorney General was John Herbert, who was appointed as the king's principal law officer in 1461. Now, his picture is a little further down the corridor, but beyond him hang his successors' pictures and latterly photographs of all the law officers winding up the stairs, and the attorney and the solicitor, by attorney and solicitor, right up to the present day. And fortunately, it's a really tall building. But attorneys and solicitors, they may all have been, but just as the pictures and photographs show the quite dramatic change in fashion over the years and the male dominance of the role, so history reveals how the role has changed. Functions adding to function as the times demanded, forging in a piecemeal and unplanned fashion that marks our constitutional settlement, the complex office that the Attorney General is today. And we, as you know, do everything extremely quickly in our country, and that's why it's taken us a mere 700 years to come to the realization that a woman might be able to discharge this burden. Now, my departments are a collective under my superintendence or sponsorship with a range of different functions. They include three statutory prosecuting departments. That's the Crown Prosecution Service, the Revenue and Customs Prosecutions Office, and the Serious Fraud Office, together with the Treasury Solicitor, my own office, Her Majesty's Crown Prosecution Service Inspectorate, and the National Fraud Authority. I also supervise and superintend about 2,000 government lawyers. I'm the leader of the bar and I sit at the apex of that number of lawyers. Now, as attorney, I also exercise non-statutory superintendence and support a range of departments and agencies which prosecute offences under the umbrella of the Government Legal Service. And the arrangements for my prosecuting departments have, like the Office of Attorney General, developed over time, and in the case of the prosecutors, in response to some very specific concerns, reviews, and reports. And more recently, the pace and depth of reform has really increased to bring us to where we are now in 2010. And the journey we've travelled helps to fill me with a degree of confidence about the further radical changes we can make to deliver the service which we will need in 2020. Now, almost 30 years ago, the Royal Commission on Criminal Procedure, the Phillips Report, assessed the prosecution service system against the criteria. One, is it fair? Two, is it open and accountable? And three, is it efficient? And subject to the overriding test of whether the system had the confidence of the public it serves. Now, the answer to those questions led to the creation of the Crown Prosecution Service, a nationally accountable but locally delivered prosecution service. The creation of the Serious Fraud Office in 1988 came hard on the heels of the Crown Prosecution Service. The 1986 Roscoe Report, which led to its creation, recommended in this instance that the investigators and the prosecutors should operate as one team on the basis that a unified control and direction, together with staff with the necessary skills, were the essential features to combat the particular threat that was posed by serious fraud. And the Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office was launched in April 2005. And that was against the background of the termination of several high-profile customs cases and two separate reviews. The Gower and Hammond Review in 2000 had identified the need for prosecutors to be independent of the investigators. And the Butterfield Report in 2003 recommended a complete separation of the prosecution function of Her Majesty's Customs and Excise criminal cases from the organisation itself through the creation of a separate prosecuting authority. Now, in the meantime, the Treasury had reviewed Her Majesty's Customs and Excise and the Inland Revenue and concluded that they should be merged. So it was decided that the Inland Revenue prosecutions would join the new independent prosecuting authority, the Revenue and Customs Prosecutions Office. And it was quite a difficult time. Confidence about the quality of prosecutions in that area had been seriously weakened. Now, since the 2000, that's the Auld Review in 2001, the role of the prosecution services and the expectation of prosecutors have expanded significantly. Lord Justice Auld explicitly recognised the vital role of strong and independent prosecutors in the delivery of effective, fair and efficient prosecutions. But by proposing an enhanced role for Crown Prosecution Service at various stages, he showed a welcome confidence in the Crown Prosecution Service itself as an integral feature of his cohesive package of recommendations to improve both the quality and the operation of the criminal justice system. And prosecutors have embraced the opportunities afforded to them by the creation of the National and Local Criminal Justice Boards, as recommended by Lord Justice Auld, working with partners to agree and implement joint actions to address key criminal justice issues, such as public confidence and the victim and witness care. And the role of the Crown Prosecutor has changed and evolved almost beyond recognition. It's certainly dramatically different than when I came to the bar in 1977. I just want to have a straw poll. How many people were not born in 1977 in this room? See? He wishes. And it's very easy to forget how different the world was then. The role of the Crown Prosecutor, therefore, is now very, very difficult, complex, and extremely important. So how has it changed? Now prosecutors engage with communities to inform their work and address their concerns, building confidence in the criminal justice system directly and enhancing the community's understanding of law, citizenship and justice. When I started in 1977, a lawyer, a prosecutor, was not allowed to talk to a victim or a witness directly. It was held at that stage to be unprofessional. And neither were prosecutors involved in any preventative work. That was seen not to be part of their brief. So radical change there. Prosecutors now advise the police and other investigating agencies pre-charge, working in partnership with investigators and barristers in private practice to build the best cases. They use out-of-court disposals, such as conditional cautions, where appropriate. They decide what to charge someone in all but the most routine cases. They take the views of the victims into account. They ensure that witnesses, particularly the vulnerable and intimidated, are able to give their best evidence. They recover assets from criminals. They present their own cases in court. And the first CPS Queen's Counsel, Graham Reeds, was appointed last year, the very first. They assist the courts in the sentencing process, and where a sentence is considered to be too lenient, they bring those decisions to the law officer's attention so that they can be appealed. When I started, there were no prosecution appeals. If a judge gave an over-lenient sentence, which perhaps sometimes may have outraged members of the public, there wasn't anything that you could effectively do about it. So a very changed waterfront. Now, of the many reforms which have helped to shape the role of the modern CPS prosecutor, the introduction of statutory charging in 2004 was a defining moment. Routinely determining the charge in all but the most straightforward of cases put the prosecutor at the epicentre of the criminal justice process as the gatekeeper for cases entering the criminal justice system. And increasingly, prosecutors are now presenting their own cases in the Crown Court, drawing on the experience of charging to build and present the strongest possible case in court. They're putting the interests of victims and witnesses at the heart of the criminal justice system, providing them with information about decisions and the process of their cases. They're providing support, though through what can be a very traumatic experience, and using their powers to provide alternatives to attendance at court and the support of intermediaries for the most vulnerable. And they're joining together with lawyers in private practice to try and ensure that the best teams and skills are marshalled to present robust but fair prosecutions. And prosecutors are becoming more responsive to community concerns, because they're working closely with neighbourhood policing teams, using a wide range of tools, such as conditional cautions, post-sentencing orders, such as antisocial behaviour orders, and confiscation orders to recover criminal assets, and working with the police, local authorities and others, on a multi-agency approach to tackle local crime concerns. And what's so interesting about prosecutors is the complexion of those who prosecute has changed. The Crown Prosecution Service has some of the most diverse people in our country representing the needs of the prosecution service, but the needs of the public also. And this means that in 2010, prosecutors are developing a much higher profile and standing in their local communities. And prosecuting authorities are being recognised and respected and are gaining public confidence for their contribution in making society a safer place. When we started in 2003, we did a survey to see how many people even recognised the term Crown Prosecution Service, and it was pitifully few. Should we just do a straw poll of this audience? How many of you were conversant with what the CPS did before today? What an informed and enlightened audience. Well, that I hope that's because we've worked very hard in the last 7 years to make sure we are more transparent and available. Now, since 2008, following an independent and comparative review into the way it undertakes cases, the Serious Fraud Office has been pursuing a comprehensive transformation of the office and the systems and the processes that they use. And it's changed the culture in a very important way, because that culture can direct the prosecution of major and complex fraud cases and enables the public, but most importantly, I think, the criminals, to take the SFO very seriously indeed. And building on the recommendations of that report, the Serious Fraud Office has introduced a number of structural changes, a range of process and casework quality improvements, such as a system of case and peer case reviews, and to assess the viability and strategic direction, and to review investigative strategies to ensure that the actions being taken are robust, legally sound, but also appropriate. And the SFO has also reassessed its relationship and how it works with other agencies. And the investigators, such as the City of London Police as the lead force on fraud, the Financial Services Authority, and the Serious and Organised Crime Agency. Now, as part of the transformation in 2010, the SFO is establishing an international reputation as a leader in the field of highly complex criminal investigations and prosecutions, and for assessing foreign jurisdictions with fraud investigations. The assistance that the SFO can now give their international partners has been very much strengthened in the last few years. And after its launch in 2005, the Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office developed into a professional and capable organisation, which has secured increasing confidence on the part of the judiciary and the public that these difficult and complicated customs and tax cases can be successfully prosecuted. And since 2005, the RCPO has completed more than 5,400 cases involving more than 7,000 defendants with a 90% conviction rate. And they have enforced confiscation orders of more than £90 million from convicted offenders, quite a feat for an organisation of fewer than 350 people. And Her Majesty's Crown Prosecution Service Inspectorate, which was established in 1995 and put on the statute book in 2000, is playing an integral part in the continuous scrutiny, improvement and assurance of the prosecution authorities, and in working with other inspectorates and audit bodies to report on cross-cutting criminal justice issues. And the youngest of my departments is the National Fraud Authority. That was established in October of 2008 as an executive agency of the Attorney General's Office, in line with a recommendation that was made in the fraud review for a single organisation to coordinate the national counter-fraud response. And the National Fraud Authority has already led to the publication of the National Fraud Strategy, which is being delivered through a combination of strategic and practical initiatives, including a counter-fraud strategy forum, whose membership includes investigation and prosecution agencies. And that broad church allows us to build a stronger evidence base for counter-fraud performance, allowing us to identify the gaps and, crucially, make proposals for improvement. And the National Fraud Authority is drawing on significant expertise in the private sector and is promoting stronger collaboration on fraud investigations and recovering the proceeds of fraud. That can be really good news. We have absolutely discovered that if we want to attack and reduce crime, we've got to make sure that the criminals understand they're likely to be detected, and if detected, that they will be relieved of the burden, and it's quite a heavy burden sometimes, of their ill-gotten gains. You need to do both if you want to counter crime. And we've learned recently, with the publication of the National Fraud Agency's annual fraud indicator report, that we now have a much improved estimate of the cost of fraud to the United Kingdom. When we started, we thought that the best figure was about 13 billion. Many people thought it was 20 billion, but we also knew that we just didn't have all the figures, the facts, in which to make that estimate real. Very much wanted the private sector and others to tell us the extent of the fraud. But that was quite difficult because many people are very embarrassed about fraud. Now we have a better figure. That figure is £30 billion. Now this staggering figure shows the damaging effect that fraud has on the United Kingdom economy. Individuals, businesses and public services are all victims. And people tend to think that fraud is a victimless crime, but it isn't. Some people who lose everything commit suicide, become very ill, and their families get destroyed. And it really isn't victimless. And even individuals who are not direct victims of fraud pay through higher charges for goods and services, and as a result of the lost tax revenue, the fund, of course, is reduced for public services. And there's an increasing cooperation right across the board. The Serious Fraud Office, the National Fraud Authority, the Serious Organised Crime Agency, the police, the Financial Services Authority, the Crown Prosecution Service, the Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office, each organisation bringing its particular expertise to bear. And the fraud picture is complex and changing, and those of us responsible for the fight against fraud need to adapt in order to tackle and target fraudsters. And being real about that, we really have to say everyone can rest assured that the fraudsters themselves are constantly doing the same thing. They're identifying our gaps and they're going for it. So we have to close those gaps as quickly as we can. And since 2000, we have also been bringing the component parts of the criminal justice system more closely together so that we can work more effectively and provide better services to victims and witnesses, hopefully reducing crime and making local communities safer and increasing public confidence. At an early stage for closer working in 1998, we sought to realign the different prosecution services. So CPS and police boundaries were brought into alignment and we created 42 areas. At the same time, we also introduced the crime and disorder reduction partnerships, bringing partners from the criminal justice system together to work in a more effective way. And in 2003, we gave the Home Secretary, the Justice Secretary, and the Attorney General joint and shared responsibility for the reform of the criminal justice system, working through the National Criminal Justice Board, replicating the arrangements for joint working locally through local criminal justice boards, and establishing a new Office of Criminal Justice Reform, which really became the clearinghouse. One of the problems we found at that stage is that each department was creating perfectly wonderful processes and systems which were absolutely fitted to their own department. They were beautiful, consummation devoutly to be wished. There was only one tiny problem. When you put these perfectly formed, quite exquisite systems together and you gave them to the practitioners, they didn't fit. And we wanted to change that. So the Office of Criminal Justice Reform was created to be like a funnel through which all these perfectly formed, beautiful ideas had to go before they hit the practitioner's desk. And it's worked. We've been able to materially change how we work together and make it work. We've also put in place a robust system to gather evidence to help us inform the improvements that we need in the service, such as the Witness and Victim Experience Survey, that's WAVES, which asks victims and witnesses of crime how well they thought the CJS, the criminal justice system, treated them, and what support they had received and what they needed. And your local WAVES data up to June 2009 will be available to view online on DirectGov from tomorrow. They knew I was coming. Now, the availability of this data and the sharing of best practice has helped to increase the victim and witness satisfaction nationally from 71% in 2005-2006 to 79% in 2008-2009. And specifically, from the prosecutor perspective, another significant change has been the way they now work closely with policymakers in Whitehall, so that the criminal justice reform and the legislation are properly informed by the experience of those who work on the front line, and the prosecution policies are developed through extensive consultation with community groups, the voluntary sector, government agencies, the police, and others, so that they are the best shaped to meet the needs of the people and the concerns of those we serve. And I have a continuing programme of reform since my appointment in 2007, July 2007, as Attorney General. And over the last couple of years, we have made bold strides to ensure that we are fit to face the challenges of the 21st century. Working with the directors whom I supervise, we have developed a new protocol on the role of the attorney and the relationship with the prosecuting departments. One of the things I recognised when I became attorney was that virtually no one, unless they had been the attorney, had a clue what the attorney actually did and or how that role related to the directors. And we all thought we really had to change that. And so what the protocol does is it sets out how I and the directors of the Crown Prosecution Service, the Serious Fraud Office, Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office exercise our functions in relation one to the other to safeguard their independence now and for the future and to ensure that there is proper accountability to Parliament and to the public. And a Law Officers Department Strategic Board, under my chairmanship, was set up for the first time in 2008. And that board has given deep consideration to the requirements for fulfilling our aim of developing a modern prosecution service. I was absolutely clear that we had to plot and plan this together and really look at the empirical evidence and craft a way through that would enable us to hone the high-quality service that we aspired to deliver. And I have led a strategic review considering likely future demands for prosecution and how that those prosecution services can be modernised to better serve the public. And the work has been driven by a real determination to ensure that we are equipped to deliver the most effective and efficient prosecution, fraud and legal service now and for the future. And last year, the Strategic Board took key decisions on modernising our services towards being more open and transparent and towards giving frontline staff the opportunity and the confidence to work in ways which would better meet local needs. And the Board has been working together and for the first time with investigators to make critical assessments about future crime trends, investigative priorities, and the future demand for prosecution, and at how, with increasing public expenditure pressures, we can achieve better value for money whilst maintaining the drive for professional excellence. And it's clear from this examination that prosecutors face substantial challenges. Crime is more complex than ever before, in part because of the rapid pace of development in technology and communications. More and more frequently, there is an international dimension in everything that we do. The effect of economic turbulence emphasizes the need to be vigilant and excellent in the protection we provide for the public. And there is an increased focus on crimes of most concern to local communities, such as gang crime, knife crime, domestic violence, hate crime, sexual assaults, rape, and antisocial behaviour. And it's also clear that the expectations of prosecution services have rightly never been higher. And the directors of my prosecuting authorities and I agree that in the face of these challenges, we should be clear about the role of a prosecution in a modern enforcement environment and should be looking to extend the expectations of us now and in the future. And we are clear that the public's right to live in safety and to be protected from criminal conduct lies right at the heart of the criminal justice system. And within that, the duty of public prosecutors is to serve their communities, protect the public, and secure justice by prosecuting firmly and fairly in open, transparent, and an independent way. So what have we done so far to meet these challenges and to put ourselves in the best possible place to carry them out? We have collectively decided to merge the Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office with the Crown Prosecution Service. It is because of the strong leadership and increasing professionalism of the Revenue and Customs Prosecution Office, as well as the significant developments in the capability and strength of the Crown Prosecution Service, that we are now in a better position to address such challenges. And the merger was brought into effect on the 1st of January of this year, when I appointed Keir Starmer QC, the Director of Public Prosecutions, to the statutory post of the Director of Revenue and Customs Prosecutions. And that merger of the RCPO and the CPS is bringing together two successful organisations, creating a modern public prosecution service which will deliver an enhanced service to the public. The new service will provide excellence in specific and specialist expert prosecution services built on the specialist expertise that already existed in both organisations, and will bring an additional resilience in order to enable us to respond to new challenges in the future. It will be an organisation better placed to provide specialist advice and prosecution services for the cases investigated by the police, the Serious Organised Crime Agency, the new UK Border Agency, and Her Majesty's Customs and Revenue and Customs. And the RCPO has significant expertise in prosecuting tax offences, and the merged service contains a specialist tax prosecution division under the leadership of David Green QC, who used to be the director of RCPO, working closely with the fraud prosecution division and the rest of the organisation, and allowing for a coordinated prosecution where a criminal has engaged in drug crime, gun crime and tax crime all at once. And we know that the criminal's activities are often very complex. They do not operate in strict silos, and therefore our prosecution response needs to be increasingly joined up. During one of our discussions, we were wondering why they are so disobliging. If we could just corral them to say, you know, CPS criminals go to the left, RCPO criminals in the middle, and SFO criminals to the right, we could have stayed where we were without any change at all. We have done this voluntarily ourselves based on the empirical data and assessment that we've made, and we think that it's the right thing to do. And by building on the existing strengths of the RCPO and the CPS in prosecuting serious complex fraud, and in the closer working with the Serious Fraud Office and the National Fraud Authority, prosecutors will have a greater capacity to identify and develop effective interventions to tackle pervasive new and emerging trends in fraud. And a significant contribution to public confidence is the knowledge that criminals will not be able to enjoy their ill-gotten gains, and the merger of RCPO and CPS brings together much expertise in using the legislation provided by Parliament to recover proceeds of crime. And just as the RCPO has developed an expert and effective service for prosecuting complex cases, working across international borders and confiscating the assets of criminals, the CPS has shown it's possible to run a locally facing service right across England and Wales, which is increasingly effective and efficient, and which also highly effective specialist divisions. The specialist crime, counter-terrorism and organised crime divisions, and the international division that works with other Whitehall partners to improve the capability of overseas jurisdictions to deal with crime before it gets to the United Kingdom. So bringing the two prosecutors together provides a comprehensive and resilient organisation able to tackle offending and to reduce crime through effective interventions. And it's in these straitened times, it also provides excellent value for money for the taxpayer, enabling us to make annual savings in excess of £8 million. Now, of course, the modern prosecutor must increasingly respond at the international level. Criminals know no borders, and so our criminal justice system must be able to respond not only in helping other nations to intervene in crime before it gets to the United Kingdom, but also to tackle international crime when it impacts on the UK. And I'm pleased that the Crown Prosecution Service has played a leading role in establishing the Global Prosecutors E-Crime Network, which brings together prosecutors across the world to share good practice and training material. And the work that our law enforcement bodies and prosecutors carry out in partnership with Europol and Eurojust and Interpol is of increasing importance. And by working in partnership with these bodies, we're able to track down and prosecute international criminals. And last year, I went to The Hague. I was visiting the Eurojust and Europol, where I was very impressed by the progress they were making together right across Europe. And there is a really first-class British team there. And Eurojust brings prosecutors from each member state of the European Union, plus representatives from other countries, working together with Europol and the national police forces to address cross-border crime. And I want to just tell you about one of the cases we explored when I was there. It was a Belgian investigation, now at the prosecution stage. It concerned credit card skimming on a European-wide scale, running to tens of millions of euros, with a wide involvement in Australia and Canada. And present at the coordination meeting for this case were teams of police and prosecutors from Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, Spain, Italy, Romania, the United Kingdom, and Canada. And the Europol officers were also in attendance to offer analytical support. Now, Belgium had previously issued a letter of request to the United Kingdom and an identical request to the Republic of Ireland to trace and interview Jerry. That's Jerry with a G, not Jerry with a J, who may live in Northern Ireland or the Republic, who may or may not drive a black BMW, and who might use one of two unsubscribed pay-as-you-go mobile telephones. Now, the United Kingdom police officers present, and you need to hang your head in shame here, gentlemen, advised the meeting that despite their best efforts, Jerry had not been found. Now, at that point, the Spanish delegation interrupted to say, "We know Jerry." His full name is Jerry X, and his parents live at address Y. His full passport number is Z, and if I remember it correctly, they said his mother's maiden name is B. Now, the shock was really worth seeing, but the value for money and efficiency in bringing together the right people at the right time was really obvious. If they had not got together, they would never have discovered the need for this information. And I'm reliably informed, just to save the British blushes, that we have had the delicious opportunity to do the same to the Spanish on other occasions. So we have helped them too. None of us know the importance of the information we have until we bring it together. And what we're doing in all sorts of different areas is pooling that information and helping each other to do far better. And I've been part of the partnership that's been trying to create a better system for a long time. And having learnt so much from what we did in our country, I thought that there was more we could do. So together with the Home Secretary and the Secretary of State for Justice, we're also working to strengthen our alliances against international crime at a strategic level. And last year, in November, I held the first inaugural meeting of the Quintet. That's a meeting with my four counterparts in the United States of America, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And the five attorneys general, we all recognise the value of sharing lessons learned across the common law countries and working together to try and meet the challenges that we all face in tackling international crime. And we have agreed to meet annually, to work together more closely, to promote cooperation on legal frameworks at the international level, to coordinate action across relevant agencies against organised crime, cybercrime, terrorism, and perpetrators of genocide. But we're also going to do work on things like domestic violence and youth crime. So, for instance, in our country, because of the work that we have done, we've been able to reduce the cost of domestic violence from the $23 billion that Sylvia Wolby identified that it was costing us in 2004 to a reduction that Sylvia Wolby last December said was $7.5 billion. We're the only country, I believe, in the world to have been able to make that reduction. And we're very, very anxious to share that expertise with our colleagues. I attended a round table on this issue in 2006 with our Spanish colleagues. They have emulated many of the things we've done, and I'm now reliably informed that domestic homicide in Spain, as a result, has been reduced by 25%. And in our country, we've got the lowest level of domestic homicide any time for the last 10 years, and we've improved the number of women who have the courage to come forward by 700%. So we know that if we can do things that are successful and we share them with our colleagues across the globe, then the pain that we've suffered does not have to be suffered by many others too. So there's real work for us to do. And we really have come a long way since 1986, and indeed, I think, since 2000. But what about our future? Looking ahead, prosecutors are clear about their role and the purpose in the 21st century, right at the heart of the fight against crime. Now, in leading the fight against crime by providing increased prosecution involvement in the development of crime reduction strategies and policies, providing unique insight for cutting-edge innovation, such as design against crime, for example. Think of the things we've already done, the difference that Chip and PIN has made to reduce credit card fraud, the ability we now have to immobilise cars to make them more difficult to steal, reducing the ability to use stolen mobile phones by disabling the SIM cards, changing the lighting in civic areas and making other environmental changes together with town and country planners so we design out crime from our areas, identifying hotspots. And the work that people like Professor Shepherd has done in Cardiff, where working on reducing the glass available in pubs to reduce the antisocial behaviour incidents and change the damage it causes when those incidents take place, as well as his work on post-traumatic stress and domestic violence. Experience which has meant that we can save lives and save money. The early intervention work of the family intervention projects. I went to see the family intervention project here in Brighton, and that project is dealing with some of the most difficult cases, the most complex cases, the most damaged cases in your area. We've got families who in the past have caused the agencies to expend between $250,000 and £350,000 per family. And with intervention now using between £6,000 and £8,000, you've got dramatic turnarounds. They've got 89.5% success rates with those families. So there is a reduction in antisocial behaviour, reduction in domestic violence, children going back to school. So we're learning many, many ways of making a difference, and early intervention is working. But we're setting the framework for decisions on whether it is in the public interest to commence a criminal investigation with a view to prosecution or some other outcome, falling short of prosecution to solve the crime problems, where investigators or regulators have powers to use a range of civil sanctions, setting the strategic direction for prosecuting fraud. The merger of RCPO and the CPS has enabled the prosecution of tax and other offences and types of fraud to be brought together for the first time. After all, criminals do not draw those nice distinctions. So all of those changes. And the National Fraud Authority has recently launched Action Fraud. Have any of you heard of Action Fraud? It's the one-stop shop, the National Fraud Reporting Centre, which gives victims of fraud the most up-to-date information and advice that is available. And Action Fraud has been operational for just 12 weeks, and it's crucial to the success of the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau. But the profile of Action Fraud is increasing, and with the public and with small businesses, they're becoming more aware of how to report fraud and the importance that it can have. Now, the consequence of the increase in the frauds which are being reported has enabled us to have an enhanced analysis by the National Fraud Intelligence Bureau, leading to stronger enforcement, prevention and detection, which will be a greater deterrent to fraudsters. The NFIB is now collecting and analysing a lot of important data which will have a big impact on the investigation of fraud. So, for example, over Christmas there were a number of reports of very small frauds. The ability to pool and analyse that information indicated that there were bigger frauds and bigger crimes being committed than we had thought had we not pooled them. And the the National Fraud Bureau is already making a difference in enabling us to make that analysis, disseminating intelligence data, which is helping us to combat the fraud that's happening in real time. And what initially seemed like just a series of low-level frauds across the country is revealed to be a highly organised network, and the Bureau can help identify where it's being organised from and give the local police forces the means to take swift and effective action. What we've noticed that the fraudsters are trying to do is to pitch their fraud just below the line where they think anybody will worry about it. The individuals think, I've just been ripped off, I've got the money back, it's only 150 quid. They hope that the police will think it's too small to identify, and they get away. If you can then add up all those small frauds, you can see the real picture, and the real picture is sometimes very frightening. It can be frauds involving millions of pounds, and those fraudsters can be linked with drug traffickers, money launderers, people traffickers, and others. And so this intelligence gathering is incredibly important. It means that we can get information more quickly, more effectively, and hopefully we can interdict and protect people in a better way. So some of the challenges now are really clear, because fraudsters and criminals are targeting in particular people who are really vulnerable, people who won't fight back, people who don't understand their rights, people who don't know where to go and or to who to speak to. And so the work we're doing is really enabling us to better protect some of the most vulnerable people in our communities. And it's a great example of the counter-fraud community working in partnership to make the United Kingdom a more hostile environment for fraudsters. Now, leading improvement in the criminal justice system, prosecutors will draw on their increasing status and confidence to influence and lead improvements to the criminal justice system as a whole. So it operates more as a service and so that together they respond swiftly, efficiently, and effectively to the new challenges ahead. And some of those challenges are already clear. The need for out-of-court disposals to be consistently applied and publicly transparent. The need for effective listing of cases in court so that all our time and energy and that of victims and witnesses are effectively used. The need to recognise that the Crown Court is predominantly a sentencing court and therefore ensure that the procedures are designed to deal effectively and quickly with those who wish to plead guilty. But the focus cannot and is not all on the big strategic issues. As I said right at the beginning, the Crown Prosecution Service is nationally accountable but locally delivered service. And prosecutors also have a critical role to play in engaging with communities and the public and securing their confidence. And the Crown Prosecution Service is already a beacon in Whitehall for its approach to equality and diversity, recognising for prosecution decisions free from bias, increased public confidence, and workplace diversity at all levels. And prosecutors continue to have a pivotal role to play in ensuring that their decisions and those of others in the Criminal Justice Service are taken without bias. And last year, we announced that we would be rolling out the community prosecutors who will engage with their local communities so that they know the types of crime that cause the most local concern and are able to take the public's view into account in their decisions and in the information they place before the courts. And community prosecutors will learn lessons in the way they handle cases, including the local hate crime panels, who comprise members of the local communities and who have experience of supporting victims and witnesses of hate crime. And the community prosecutor approach will allow the public prosecution service to ensure that our criminal laws and procedures are relevant, practical, and effective. And based on the real experience of those who work in the criminal justice service, just as importantly, to identify which offences are no longer relevant in today's society. And above all, the community prosecutors will be an integral part of a modern prosecution what the modern prosecution service does. And the public rightly expect a public prosecution service which is visible, accountable, and responsive to community concerns. Now, as a natural evolution, community prosecutors are a key, I think, to delivering all of that. But this isn't about creating new roles or extra burdens, it's about redefining the ethos which underpins what prosecutors do. And prosecutors are adapting to meet the demands of a changing landscape. And I really am confident that they will continue to do so. One example I just want to give is the CPS Derbyshire project, because it's a genuine example of how something can start off very small and importantly with those who work in a local setting and can develop. The CPS now have an ambitious national schools project, which is a testament to our ability to identify what works, to hone it, and to give it an opportunity to take root on a bigger scale. The project had really small beginnings. In 2007, the CPS Derbyshire, in conjunction with the Derbyshire County Council local authority, developed two interactive lessons to deliver key stage 3 and 4. That's for children between the age of 11 and 16. And has grown so much since that time. We are now in a position to roll it out nationally. And this interactive session forms part of the mandatory national citizenship curriculum, the purpose of which is to equip pupils with the knowledge and skills needed for effective and democratic participation. And it helps pupils become informed, active citizens. So how does it do it? Teaching pupils about their rights, responsibilities, duties and freedoms, about the law, justice and democracy, encouraging respect for different nationalities, religious and ethnic identities, enabling pupils to learn how society has changed and how it continues to change in the United Kingdom, Europe and the wider world, and helping young people to develop their decision-making and critical skills and developing the ability to argue a case. Now, we learnt that transparency is key to building confidence. And so what we did with the 13-year-olds is to give them a real-life case, which they were able to act out and play the different parts. And it was a stunning opportunity. I had an opportunity to go and see a Derbyshire school and to hear 13-year-olds argue about the two prosecutorial tests had to be seen to be believed. And I'm going to be really kind to you and say that I'm sure you know what the two prosecutorial tests are and not test you, because I'm sure that you could beat 13-year-olds, couldn't you? Shall I try it? What's the first test? Who wants to tell me what the first prosecutorial test is? We have erudite law students in front of me. Two tests. What's the first test? First test. I am ashamed of you lot. The evidential test. The second test is the public interest. You're right. And I went into a room and there was a debate with the 13-year-olds and it went like this. Well, as for the evidential test, I don't think you've got it. I think we need special measures. Well, she can't do special measures. And eventually they came up with a way that they thought they might get over the evidential test and they were satisfied. And then they turned to the public interest. And they said, what about the public interest? One said, well, there's far too much of this going on. We need to do something about it. But what was fantastic was that they had understood all the principles. And we then gave them a case which had failed to see whether they could apply the same principles. And they did. And they decided that notwithstanding the special measures, notwithstanding the opportunities there were to support victims, that they couldn't get over the evidential test. And they would have to look for more evidence. We then showed the children the press coverage that went with that case. And the press coverage said, no justice for Holly. And the kids went wild. They said, this is so unfair. We went through the test. There wasn't any evidence. This is outrageous. But it taught them a very important lesson, because we then were able to talk about perception and reality and the independence of a prosecutor and the what you have to do and why you can't believe everything you see in the press. We didn't say that, but the children learnt it. And they were then going off. Actually, I think the teacher's going to hate us, because the children then wanted to go to see the court, they wanted to come to Parliament, they wanted to see how law was made. And they had actually come alive with what justice was. And that's what the Derbyshire project is about. It's about going into schools and making justice come alive for children so they can really understand it's part of theirs. And so we've learnt about transparency. We learn about what the core standards has to be. And the statutory prosecutors are accountable through me to Parliament for what they provide. And the other side of the coin is that public must know about the quality of service they should expect. Now, I have almost come to the end, but I think you've suffered so much, I'm going to skip most of it. The criminal justice system is underpinned by the rule of law, and respect for human rights is right at the heart of a modern democracy, right at the heart of who we are as a country. And a modern prosecution service focused on protecting the public by reducing crime, delivering justice and supporting victims and witnesses is right at the centre of everything we need to do as part of the system. The service that I aspire us to have in 2020 will also need to be cosmopolitan. It must build alliances and work in partnership with others across the globe. We just can't do this on our own. Just as criminals and their networks know no borders, so must prosecutors build even more effective networks, collaborating with their counterparts and using our collective knowledge and skill to outmaneuver criminals who are conspiring all the time. Fair, fearless, effective, open, honest, transparent, protective, supportive, networked, but above all, independent. These are the qualities that the public has a right to expect of its public prosecuting service, and the public prosecutors are determined to meet those expectations. I hope there will be some in this audience who may become the prosecutors of tomorrow. I hope that there may be a future Attorney General or two in the room. Gentlemen, I wish you bon chance, and ladies, I look forward to welcoming you.